All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 25 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing with the story of ancient Egypt. Today's pretty much the last lecture on ancient Egypt, because in our study of the ancient past, we have a challenge, that is to maintain a proper posture with regard to the vastness of it all and the just the sheer bulk of the story and the sheer quantity of all the information that we encounter, especially since it is so distant from us, so many thousands of years removed from the life that we live today. And so to do that properly, and my term for that is present centrism, to approach the story of the ancient past, and in particular the archaic past, present centrically, requires that we are really ruthless in seeking out the information that still has whatever small measure of compelling quality to it today, here and now. And there isn't much. Egypt is a culture that interests us in the present, that even summons any of our attention at all in the first place, because the Egyptians built the pyramids. So that's our starting point. That the building of the pyramids is the great anchor fact of Egyptian history. And so that's what we have on our timeline of Egyptian history, in which we're going to add to our overall timeline of ancient history, is the construction of the pyramids. And that is what beckons us into this story. And we wouldn't be able to do it at all, of course, without the Rosetta Stone. So that becomes our key for deciphering everything that we encounter. And it permits us then to go back and to see that the Egyptians built pyramids for about a 500-year period. And that the pyramids that we are so familiar with, that everybody knows as the symbol of ancient Egypt, the pyramids at Giza, the greatest of the pyramids, were built around 2500 or so, as part of this age of pyramids that began back in 2615, that goes through all the way to the reign of Pepi II, and a little bit beyond, and that's it. Never again. So this archaic culture that's disconnected from us, we do have a tether to that culture in the form of these monuments that interest us. And based on the Rosetta Stone and the information we can gather there, we can then go back and study the age of the pyramids. But then what we find is that culture, the culture that did that, actually significantly degrades. It significantly, well, in a sense, in a very real sense, it collapses. And after the reign of Pepi II, we have the rule of the nomarchs. We have an intermediate period where Egypt, Upper and Lower Egypt, are no longer unified and so on. And then, yes, we do find that it comes back together again. But the Egypt that comes back together again in the reign of this pharaoh here, Mentuhotep II, is not quite the Egypt that once was. It's not the Egypt of pyramid builders anymore. We know from studying Mentuhotep's tomb, right? If I go back, not to this, pardon me. I've got the wrong image up on my screen. We'll get to that in a minute. Let me go back to this. We know that Mentuhotep built a rock-cut tomb. And we know that the Egyptian culture surrounding the pharaohs, right, the pharaoh-centric culture, we could call it, was significantly modified after him, because he was not a god king. He was a vizier. He was a vizier who must have conspired with various nomarchs to take power, using that raw, brutal method of every other conqueror and unifier like Menes Narmer, which is slaughter your enemies. And if you got the biggest and the strongest army, then you get power. Well, there's nothing godly about that. It's really disgusting and barbaric. And it's pretty evident that Mentuhotep II did not really uphold the whole God-King approach with his tomb and so on, with the fact that it was placed not in Lower Egypt. If we go back to our geography, right, it wasn't at Giza, it was at Thebes. So it wasn't a pyramid in Lower Egypt symbolizing the unity of the country. It was a pyramid in Upper Egypt, hidden, in a sense, from the bulk of the population of the country down here. So that's very symbolic of a change in Egypt. And basically, after the Age of Pyramids is over, Egypt becomes pretty unremarkable. It's as plain as that. The Egyptians are not doing anything that would really summon much of our attention. There isn't anything that's particularly special or notable. I did mention, you know, a canal, and there were some projects that they undertook to try to improve life. Okay, right. But nothing of those things, though, that really, certainly nothing of it that has shaped the world that we live in. It's all temporary, and didn't have any lasting cultural significance for the world. There really isn't anything that they do after the pyramids that would require that we pay special attention to them in the study of history. If we were, and to look at it from a slightly different angle, if we were to spend too much time studying the Egyptians, in other words, if we really dug into it and we went and we found all the little fascinating minutiae, and certainly there is a bunch of it, we could choose to look at all kinds of varieties of things concerning ancient Egypt. We could. If we spent all that time studying them, here's what would go wrong. We wouldn't have enough time to study far more important things. So this is our fundamental problem, right? In terms of historical inquiry, in terms of historical research, we are here now. And the past is this vast thing that we have to contend with, and we have to choose what to look at and what not to. If we choose badly, we end up wasting our time. We end up looking at stuff that doesn't deserve to be looked at. But again, from the flip side of that is, we end up not looking at stuff that should be looked at. Stuff that has genuine value here and now to help us understand the world that we're living in. That's the potential. I mean, it ranges in terms of severity, in terms of how dangerous it is to make this mistake. But basically, it ranges from damaging to catastrophic in terms of its potential significance. If you study the wrong stuff and you fail to study the right stuff, then really, history is not serving you the way that it should. My job, of course, is to serve you. Give you knowledge that matters, to expose you to things in history that are instructive, that help you understand life, help you to understand the world that you're living in, and live better in it. So, as far as Egypt is concerned after the pyramids, there really isn't anything important. Excuse me. But, going back to the timeline. In 1922, there was a really exciting discovery by an archaeologist named Howard Carter. And an episode of Egyptian history became especially compelling to modern people in general concerning ancient Egypt. In other words, it became a very sensational kind of thing to learn about this character whose tomb was discovered, and then the controversies surrounding his life and so on. And so this one artifact just one single artifact just caused quite a radical shift in terms of our priorities with regard to ancient Egypt. We had the pyramids, we're looking at them forever. Move that over here. We had the pyramids and we were looking at them forever, and then all of a sudden somebody finds this. And everybody wants to look at this. It's super, it's amazing, it's gold, it's just, oh, and who is this character and what's the story of his life and so on. Well, that becomes the new rage when it comes to this archaic culture. And here's the photograph of his mummy. The studies of the mummy reveal that he has a broken leg, I think it is, that he's a child and so on. There's so many things that were learned. And that just becomes the thing that people are most fascinated about. Sure, they're fascinated about the pyramids, but those are always there. This is the new thing. This is somewhat kind of a fashion, but it still becomes this one thing that modern people looking back on Egypt still want to know more about. So it does change Egyptian history and give us one other episode to study. One other thing to kind of look back on and put it down on our timeline here and just be appraised of it. Think about it. And it is a fascinating episode because King Tut, not King Tut himself, but rather King Tut's father, did try to do something important. So, the building of the pyramids is the one important thing the Egyptians did. But King Tut's father tried to do one other. Tried to do one other thing. I say tried. This is a little bit of a giveaway, but since we have King Tut's amazing sarcophagus and death mask that is so compelling, and since his story is tied to a pharaoh who tried to do something quite fascinating and important, then that just leaps out at us as one other episode worth looking at. So that's what we're going to do today. One final story about life in ancient Egypt and having to do with King Tut and his father. So, let's see here. King Tut and his father. Let me put this away. Not this either for the moment. Sorry. Let me see here. I guess my screen is a little bit of a mess today. I apologize for that. King Tut's father, here we are, was called Amenhotep IV. Try to take that down if you can. I'll enlarge it there for you. If you're taking notes, that's definitely one thing you want to get down. King Tut's father was called Amenhotep IV. If you look over on the right-hand side, you'll see five different versions of his name. Or maybe six or seven. I don't know. There's a ton of them there. First of all, there's the hieroglyphic inscription. And then there's Amenhotep, there's Imenhetep, there's Imenhotep, there's Imenhetep, there's Amun is, please, is the English version of the name. That's what Amunhotep means. It means the god Amun is pleased. And as you can see, Amunhotep IV, who was King Tut's father, was the fourth pharaoh of a dynasty. Technically, strictly the 18th dynasty in Egyptian history up to that point. So by this time, if you want some dates for him, I like to use a single date just to kind of get it down. So you could use 1334 with maybe a circa on there is not a bad date. Circa 1334 for Amenhotep IV. That's about when he died. Rosie, you have a question or comment?
Died.
Yeah, that's what we're going to use for his particular date because we don't know much more about him. A lot of Egyptian dates are very Woozy. So we're going to use, say, circa 1334 for his death. Okay? Which is going to be a very important fact. Okay. So as I said, his name means Amun is pleased. But it just occurs to me that's kind of an ironic name because he was not very pleased with the state of Egyptian religion. So Egyptian religion was a very complex and a thing with a variety of different gods. His own pharaoh name, Amenhotep, was focused on the god Amun or Amun-Ra, the sun god. But there were many other gods, and the religion had over time become quite different than it was in the time of the pharaohs of the pyramids, of the age of the pyramids. The pharaoh had become, in a way, much less important to the religion. Pardon me this confusion here. Let me get rid of my, I didn't want that to pop up. The pharaoh had become quite a bit less important to the Egyptian religion. And it previously had been the case that, for instance, only the pharaoh had special kind of special magical abilities to go to the afterlife. And there were special spells and magic incantations and stuff and special equipment that went in the pharaoh's tomb in order to help him in the afterlife. Well, by the time of Akhenaten, that had changed quite a bit. And there was actually something called the Book of the Dead, which was, as it says here, a funerary text that was much more widely used. You might notice here on this page it says that it was intended to assist a dead person's journey through the underworld and into the afterlife. But notice what it says. It says dead person. So in other words, not merely a dead pharaoh. No, this is not reserved for the pharaohs. The pharaohs and whatever the fate of their, souls in the afterlife was no longer the central concern of Egyptian civilization, right? As it had been so symbolically with the pyramids. Now the Book of the Dead is for everybody. And this is the most famous illustration from the Book of the Dead. It's a scale that shows a kind of supernatural moment of truth. Does anybody know what this is? Sometimes people already recognize this one from their readings of various, sources on Egyptian history. But it's like the scales of justice, but it's more a weighing of the character or soul of a person in the afterlife, any person. And in this crucial judgment in the afterlife, the character's heart is on the left-hand side. And this is, I believe this is Anubis, which is a god of something or other, I can't remember. Anyway, it was weighing the heart here. And what it's being weighed against is pretty fascinating. This is called the feather of truth. And what do you notice about this interesting moment when it concerns, right, the fate of the soul of whatever person this is, right, in the afterlife? Their heart is being weighed against the feather of truth. What do you suppose that means? What's happening here? And what's kind of neat about this particular depiction? Theo, what's your sense of it?
Well, it's, it's deciding whether they're gonna go to the afterlife or not, I think.
Right, be able to pass through the underworld, which would probably be kind of like a hell, to use a Christian notion, right? And then through to something better. And so your heart against the feather of truth, what do you suppose the judgment is there?
I
Alexander?
Well, if your heart is heavier, then your heart is too heavy. You sin too much or whatever. And then you don't get to go to the nice place. And if your heart is lighter than the feather, then you've done lots of good things. And you do get to go to the nice place.
Yeah, I think that would probably be a pretty good symbolic guess, right? Because naturally, a heart is heavier than a feather. But since it's the feather of truth... You got a different kind of measurement going on here. And so, yeah, if the feather's heavier than your heart, then I suppose then, yes, there's something here that says, yes, your heart is free of sin or something to that effect, right? And therefore, you are judged to be worthy to go to the afterlife. So presumably you're pious and you've been a good follower of Egyptian belief and whatnot, and the gods will welcome you and so on. Something to that effect, right? And along with that, people's tombs would be filled with these little figurines called Shabti figures. And so if you go to an American Museum of History, pretty much in any big city nowadays, you'll find a section on Egypt, because there's so many artifacts. And in that, I guarantee you will find some kind of display of Shabti figures. And so, if you've got a pharaoh, then he might have an army of Shabti figures these magical creatures that would come to life in the afterlife and help him. If you are a regular person, then you've got some assortment of these other characters here. And so they are going to do things for you. And you've got the Book of the Dead and you've got magical spells and so on and so forth. So you can get through, you've kind of got a cheat sheet for the afterlife, and you can get through whatever tests you're going to be put through. And you'll have the help of enough characters. And so presumably, if you're buying these Shabti figures, you're also buying them in a sense, you're paying the priests and you're participating in the religion in a certain way. So you're proving your piety. You got the tomb and so on, and you've done all the rituals and so on. So hopefully you're going to the afterlife. So this was kind of the state of Egyptian religion in the time of Amenhotep IV. It had become, in a way, much more popularized, or some people might be tempted to use the word democratic in a sense, or perhaps one might say it had been leveled. So it wasn't necessarily quite as acutely focused on the single person of the pharaoh, but was kind of more accessible. The afterlife was more accessible to everybody. Amenhotep is a very interesting character because he wanted to reverse this trend in a sense and go back to having a religion in which the pharaoh was central to the belief. And his way of going about it was very interesting. He decided that if we're going to have one person in the world be the conduit to the supernatural and be the most important person, then he decided that he was going to basically swipe the slate clean, wipe it clean, and have a single god as well. So, and this god would be the sun. So, he was already named as Amenhotep. He was named in a way after the sun god. But he wanted this new kind of sun worship of this only god to be distinct from that. So instead, he decided to set up his new version of Egyptian religion, stripped of all its other gods and focused exclusively on the sun. He wanted to have it worship merely the disk of the sun, which in that that ancient language was called the Aten, Aten. I'll come back to this in a second. So, which is why we have what he did. We have the Aten here. Let me go to this webpage because it's kind of cool. So the symbol of the sun disk with its warm rays extending down onto the earth and basically providing life, right? The creator and giver of life in this world. And so he decided, all right, this is going to be the focus of the entire religion, the Aten. And so his religion that he's going to try to create is sometimes called Atenism. And here we see an image of him as the pharaoh making offerings to the sun disk, whose rays are shining down on him. And over in this particular engraving, it's kind of easier to see kind of the symbol of the sun rays and then little hands that come down to caress the figures down on earth. And here we have the pharaoh and his wife and their children and, you know, a whole bunch of dedications, of course, to the Aten. And so this was his new concept. He's going to have a variation of Egyptian religion that would be focused exclusively on the sun god, and he himself would be the conduit of all of the worship of the country towards that single god. So it's not quite the traditional god-king kind of a concept. Right? We don't have the same kind of assertion of his own godliness. But it's interesting because he changed his name, and that reveals to a certain degree what the character of this religion was. So he changed his name from Amenhotep to Akhenaten. And that means, well, this is kind of a short version, but it means acting on behalf of the Aten. Acting on behalf of the Aten. So if there's only one god, the Aten, well, we need, in this religion, one person on earth who will direct, conduct this proper worship of the one God, somebody who will act effectively on behalf of the Aten. We need Akhenaten. All right, so how do you change a religion? I mean, imagine this: the gall of the character, but conceit to a certain extent, or maybe it's something else, right? But just this incredible ambition of this one individual to completely remake the religion. How do you do it? Well, step one was the name change. So step one was the name change. Get rid of the name Amenhotep and turn it into Akhenaten. So he's going to have a new name reflecting the new worship. Okay, but what else do you have to do? Especially since you want to turn it into a religion that's dedicated to only one god. So what are you going to have to do with the other gods, Theo?
Well, you got to make them disappear.
Got to get rid of them. Okay, how do you do that?
Well, you could chisel them off all sorts of, like, engravings and destroy all the papyruses with their names, that sort of thing.
Okay, right. So you got to go and have your men destroy the temples and chisel off the inscriptions of the names of the other gods and so on. Get rid of them on the monuments and so on. Okay, so imagine, I mean, that's going to be a big task because you have a whole civilization which for 1,500 years already has been dedicated to building up these religious beliefs and is full of temples and monuments and inscriptions and so on. So, all right, you want to get started on that task? Okay. Now, but what else do you have to do? I mean, you have the inscriptions. You have all of the monuments and temples. All right, those are the physical, you know, manifestations of all of that belief. What else do you have to do in order to displace an entrenched religious belief? Even if all of the inscriptions are gone, what else do you have to get rid of? What happens when you don't have any writing anymore concerning something? Is it still possible to propagate a belief or a set of ideas without writing? What do you need? Alexander?
Well, basically you need to convince everybody that you're right.
Okay, so, yeah, I agree with you. That's a good way of putting it. So what do you have to do? I mean, you've got your message, and you are going to remove all of the other references to the other gods, okay, but how do you make sure that it's only your message that's getting out there? What stands in your way? Keen?
You have the people. You have what's in their mind. You have to somehow censor them, make it a crime, perhaps, to speak of the old gods, to share those ideas.
Okay, but who especially is going to be dedicated in their lives to the old gods? Who is it that's especially that's standing in your way if you want to pull off this transformation in the culture? Who do you have to deal with? King?
The priests.
The priesthood. The priesthood of the traditional religion, right? Because they live their lives in that unique caste in society that the society supports by promoting that religious belief, by performing the rituals, by organizing the society in its religious dimension. So yes, they are the key. So not surprisingly, Akhenaten fired the priests, basically, right? He said, no more money for you guys, no more support for you. And ordered, and as you said, King, made it illegal to celebrate the traditional religious festivals. So you can't do that anymore, on pain of death. So if you're a priest, no more talking about the other gods, and you can't, basically you've got no more money. So hopefully that's, if you can remove the funding from the religion, then you can probably erase it. That's by at some point, then on the other hand, he also made it illegal as you said, censored, right, the practice of the other forms of religious worship. So yeah, this is definitely what a ruler would have to do in this situation. In addition, he and his wife, and he moved the royal family away from the traditional capital, which was steeped in the old religion, so Thebes was the traditional capital, and he had a new capital called Akhetaten constructed, spelled variously, as you might have seen, right? There's different ways to write every single Egyptian name. So it could be A-T-E-N here, or Akhetaten, or Akhetaten was his new capital city, so that the entire royal household was basically moved 100 miles away from that, the old traditional center of Egyptian religion, and hopefully that would permit or at least facilitate the change. Okay, what else would you have to do? Well, no more Book of the Dead, right? No more special rituals for everybody involving all of these other types of religious beliefs. So instead, the only funerary text, as it's called, right? The only funerary text allowed was a new volume called The Great Hymn to the Aten. So if you wanted to get to the afterlife, Well, if there's only one God, then, well, you've got to go through the only one God. So the funerary text became the great, the only valid, the only acceptable funerary text was the great hymn to the Aten. So if you could get this message to be promoted within the culture, if you could eliminate the competing religious belief, if you could make it illegal, if you could outlaw the priesthood, if you could remove even the physical references to the other gods, well, you are doing a lot here to erode that belief, to erode even any symbol of that, the existence of connected to that belief. So that's going a long way. But, can one man during one lifetime destroy an entire religious culture? I mean, not destroy, but remake an entire religious culture. That was meant to be an easy question. Alexander?
Probably not.
No.
Considering that it said that he only ruled for about 17 years.
Yeah, but no, it doesn't matter how long you live. I mean, one person cannot possibly destroy, well, especially that oral tradition, any stories that people tell each other by the campfires at night, and all of the monuments, and all of the tombs, and all of what, you know, what compose a culture, can't possibly be transformed within the span of the lifetime of one person, and never have in any culture. We look at the rise of any religion, we see that it's a multi-generational process involving many, many people that commit to a belief and transmit that belief and foster its growth and so on. So, where does it start, right? You got the one guy, you have Akhenaten, and he has made enormous changes. He has undertaken an enormous effort to change the religion. Now you tell me, what is the single most important factor that will determine whether or not the changes he made are sustained, let alone rendered permanent? What is the single most important factor? King?
His successor has to continue has to believe in it and continue his work.
The existence of a successor who will continue his work. Exactly. There's got to be another generation and another and so on. So when you have a pharaoh and you have dynasties, what does the pharaoh need? Well, that was meant to be another easy question. I'll give you a hint. What did Henry VIII of England need in order to make his religious changes? King?
You need a wife who will bear you children, a son.
Yeah, you need a son, right? And so Akhenaten had a wife. Her name was Nefertiti. Here she is. But, and this is where there's some fascinating symmetry to history, Nefertiti gave Akhenaten 6 daughters. So, I laugh because if you remember the story of Henry VIII, he didn't have 6 daughters, but he did have 6 wives. So there's kind of, that's what I'm talking about in the amusing symmetry here. So Akhenaten had 6 daughters through Nefertiti. Of course, he was very concerned to have a son, and therefore he took many wives. I don't know exactly how many. Finally, one of them gave him a son, and that son had a quite interesting name. That son was called Tutankhaten. Sound familiar? Well, sort of. Sort of. Right? Because we know this pharaoh called King Tut. We know that he was called Tutankhamun. Well, but his given name was Tutankhaten. And that's part of what makes his story so fascinating. Because we do not, pardon me, we do not remember this character as Tutankhaten. We remember him as, pardon me, we remember him as Tutankhamun. Why? Did the Egyptian reformation of Akhenaten succeed? What's in a name? We can know the answer. Did the Egyptian reformation of Akhenaten succeed? If his son is known to us as Tutankhamun, Alexander.
No.
Why?
Well, I don't remember exactly why, but somebody...
No, but I'm giving you massive hints. I'm giving you massive hints here. You're ignoring my hint. We don't know this person as Tutankhaten. We know him as Tutankhamun. That's all you need to know. Why?
Okay. Oh, because his name was switched back to the old religion where everyone's name ended with Amen, because it was the
the god Amen, which is short for Amen Ra.
God instead of the new god, so his religion didn't succeed.
Right. Even this next generation, the second generation, his only son, Tutankhaten, his name was not kept. His given name was switched to Tutankhamun. Yes, we also know that Tutankhamun died young. And we can imagine what the whole context for that would have been. And it's not surprising that there are a lot of conspiracies or conspiracy theories, right, pertaining to what was going on at the time. Because he died young. But also, he was the second pharaoh in this family that would have attempted to impose a new religion. So, it's hardly kind of mysterious to know, you know, to guess or to imagine how much upheaval there would have been in Egyptian society at that time. Right? And we know that he died young. If he was a child pharaoh like Pepi II, tell me what we know about his rule. Even if we don't know the details. Right? Go back to our image of Pepi II if we can find it here. There. What do we know about the rule of Tutankhamun if it looks like this? Looks like you guys have run out of steam. Let's just finish up. He was a child, and therefore, was he really in charge? Alexander?
No, there was somebody else who was, like, doing all the real stuff, probably.
Yeah, we would have had characters like the vizier. We would have had his mother. We probably would have had his older sisters. You can imagine that they probably would have been a lot of trouble. And you've got the nomarchs and whoever else, a variety of characters that would have been conspiring within a society that was really being shaken up, really violently here because of a religious, internal religious conflict. And, well, at some point, his name is changed to Tutankhamun. So, after Akhenaten dies, the religion begins to go back to the way that it was. As I like to call it, the status quo ante Aten. All right, so, as far as we are concerned, I mean, this is the last historically interesting thing that the Egyptians ever did. They had a religious upheaval in which one of the pharaohs attempted to radically remake the religion. That pharaoh was Akhenaten. He had a son who became, of course, very famous. And because of the discovery of his tomb in 1922, that son, Tutankhamun, as he is known to us, symbolizes the failure of the religious change of his father. But that's about it. That's as far as we go with Egypt. Because they didn't do anything after this that's particularly interesting. The only thing that Egypt is notable for after this episode is all of the wars that it is involved in with its neighbors. And specifically, it is notable because this most ancient of civilizations, most established and isolated of civilizations, is going to be defeated, and it is going to be conquered repeatedly by one civilization after another until finally Islam comes in 622 AD and thereafter, and archaic Egyptian culture disappears completely. So, for the remainder of our ancient history story, the only thing that Egypt is going to do is, or the only part that Egypt is going to play, essentially, is as a member of the ancient balance of power, and as a weaker member, and as a target, and as a country which typically is going to be attacked and defeated and conquered by others. So that's it. Tomorrow, we will look at the first of the cultures that's going to do that. We're going to look at a neighboring archaic culture, the culture of what's called Mesopotamia, and we'll start to weave those two stories together. Keen, go ahead.
Do you think that if the new religion has succeeded and the God King mentality or the God King tradition had been restored, could it really have brought Egypt back to its previous greatness? Like, was that alone enough to do it?
So I don't think, the first key thing is, I don't think that Akhenism maintained the God King concept in the same way. So in other words, the way that I tried to characterize it here was, remember, Akhenaten means acting on behalf of the Aten. So in other words, the pharaoh's role within this new religion is to be the primary conduit between the people and the gods, to be the central leader of religious worship. So kind of a good comparison would be kind of like the Pope in Catholic Christianity. So the one, you know, figure at the absolute top of the hierarchy, but not godly in the same way that used to be asserted. I don't think we would ever get pyramids ever again or anything like that. But, you know, it's a giant what if, so I don't know. But would there then be more to say about Egypt? Yeah, there probably would be, because then the question would be, what is the fate of this belief? We know that it would have died off eventually, because it's not really the presence of that particular belief or any particular Egyptian belief that's going to determine whether or not Egypt it succeeds or not. When Egypt collides with Greece, and then finally Rome, and then penultimately Rome, and is ruled by Rome for many centuries, and then collides with Islam. I mean, it was not a culture that could possibly absorb all of those blows. So even the religion of the pharaohs of the, you know, who built the pyramids couldn't have survived that onslaught by external cultures. So that's my judgment of it. I think that we would probably have more to say, but still, again, it would still be very much a limited thing. And in Egypt would still be very much an archaic culture. Interesting question, though. Yeah, because, I mean, I think that the point is, it would have been, it would be more interesting because it would have been a culture that became infused with a new religious zeal. Typically, cultures that exhibit that tend to be more active and accomplish different things. And so, yeah, we would probably have something else to study pertaining to that. And then we would have studied the collision of that culture with all of the other Mediterranean and Mesopotamian cultures. And you know, it might have done a little bit better here or there, but I'm pretty comfortable in saying that it would never have been able to stand up to the Romans, nor to Alexander the Great and to Islam later either. So I don't see that, you know, that particular change as shifting the trajectory of history or giving Egyptian history a trajectory that it didn't have in the first place. Cool question. All right. So anyway, so yeah, tomorrow we start with Mesopotamia. All right. Talk to you then, folks. Bye for now.
Bye.
See ya.